joining me to discuss the events that are upcoming today in the case of Brian Koberger, former felony prosecutor and attorney Eric Fattis is with us. It is a rather important day, it seems, in the ongoing saga of Brian Koberger. The motion to compel is going to be up there, an attempt to, by the defense to persuade prosecutors to share various evidence, such as communication between lab personnel and any other party related to biological testing in this case, all documents related to genetic and genealogical testing, including documents and samples of unknown males that were identified in the reports and any logs related to unexpected DNA results, and corrective actions, and some other requests as well. How pivotal is this motion for the defense of Brian Koberger?
I think it's pretty darn important, as far as I can tell at this stage. You know, the DNA evidence could be terribly problematic for Koberger. Now I did read one report, and I don't know if it's been verified or what have you, but one article had stated that the prosecution might reconsider using some of that genetic genealogy evidence that they have. You know, I think all of this is going to come down on Friday. We're going to know a lot more then. Mm-hmm. But that's really the strongest argument Koberger is going to have to fight this DNA evidence, is to try to prove that it was obtained in a way that did not meet standards and that could give rise to error and that could potentially result in a false positive. And one way you do that is really attacking the chain of custody. You look into those communications and see if there was any sort of partiality that may be evidenced therein. And so I think that this motion is pretty important for them if the prosecution does go forward with the genetic genealogic evidence.
The faulty testing is really, I think, what they're going to try and point at, if there is anything that, like you said, any errors, any faultiness. But when it comes down to a false positive with DNA, it's easy to say that term. And if you don't know much about it, a lot of the general public will be like, oh, you know, right, wrong, black, white. Of course, there could be some faultiness. But we're really talking about, to make an analogy, a combination of a lot of numbers that have to be in the exact correct order when matched up over and over again to be Brian Koberger's. And if that does match, regardless of if it was somehow mishandled in a lab or moved this way or that way, it doesn't create a false positive, if you will. The odds of that are slim to almost nothing whatsoever with the type of DNA that they're testing. On the surface, again, you use false positive and positive, and it's just black or white. A jury, one member who doesn't quite understand that could easily believe that sort of an idea. But if you really look at it, yeah, could there have been some mishandling, but it doesn't necessarily change the outcome of it. It's like if you have a key, you give it to somebody else, maybe they got Dr. Pepper on it, they poured it accidentally in their car. The key is still going to work. It's still the same key for the right door.
I totally hear what you're saying. But one thing to consider is, you know, I'm wondering if Koberger's defense is going to try to argue that this DNA was planted. And so if the Koberger team can also identify other mishandling, other errors, other things that raise eyebrows and that are cause for concern and that are not in line with sort of the standards by which authorities obtain and test DNA evidence, maybe that is just an additional part of Koberger's argument that all of this DNA stuff is actually, wasn't properly obtained and should not be relied on. And in fact, it's their theory that it was planted. I'm not sure. We're not at that stage yet. But I'm just wondering if they're going to try to use some of this alleged faultiness in the testing, if there was any, to support a larger theory that this DNA evidence was planted.
Now, planted is one thing. That's different than the tests coming back and them looking at the chain of custody and how things were handled as maybe being off. But if it was planted, that's a whole different accusation. How risky is it to go down that road? Because it pretty much puts all of your cards in one hand. All your eggs are in the one basket of the direction you're going to go on this. It's not a lot of room to navigate off of that. If somewhere in the trial, it's very clearly shown that there's no way in hell this was planted. But to go down that road, is there a lot of risk involved to make such a claim?
Oh, heck yes. Yeah, that's a super risky argument to take. And you better bring it if you're going to put that in front of a jury as a defense attorney. You better be able to back it up. And because, you know, it's also what you're arguing is that to a jury that, the whole system is completely corrupt and they're just totally trying to frame a completely innocent dude for a quadruple homicide. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty tall accusation to make if you can't back it up. So, and also that if you're defense arguing that the DNA was planted, you're essentially also conceding that it was in fact your client's DNA. So you no longer have the argument that, you know, the testing was wrong and you shouldn't rely on the conclusion. And so it sort of divests you of one additional argument. So yeah, huge risk. Sometimes it pays off. You usually need a pretty darn savvy attorney to even be able to make that argument. But heck, that, you know, we'll have to see how his team does.
This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast
with Tony Bruschi.